But listen to what your colleague, Mr. Gogo, says. He says, Eskom is perplexed by this about turn, given the events of the past few months, and at the blatant disregard Optimum displays for the impact that the threats of liquidation has on the precarious balance of electricity security and commercial viability. As a Glencore operation, Optimum surely cannot be perceived to be acting in the national interest. But that has got nothing to do with Mr. Gogo. That is a decision to be made by Glencore, which Glencore has made. The reason, the importance of this letter, is I put to you that here you are writing, and this letter was written actually, at the time the contract was to be signed. You've alluded to that. They were already negotiating terms, because here DMR is being required to facilitate compliance with the suspensive conditions of the contract. Is that correct?
So, which contract are you referring to, sir?
The sale agreement. The sale agreement between Tegeta
and Glencore.
And Glencore.
I would assume so, yes, sir.
So, and what is sought there, and actually what comes out of DMR, is that Eskom must help the potential acquirers of Optima, which is Tegeta, with cash injection. What is your response to that?
That is my reading of the response from DMR, sir.
So Eskom is going out of its way to ask DMR, one, to facilitate the authorizations as well as some form of getting some cash injection to Tegeta. Why?
So my understanding is that Eskom identified a security supply risk by Mr. Coco's letter. We then requested assistance to mitigate that security of supply risk. I don't think it was ESCOM's suggestion that we should enter into a prepayment or upfront payment of sorts. I think that was a response that we received from DMR, in the letter from DMR.
And this is on the 6th. And who is the minister at DMR at the time?
I would not know, sir.
Would it be correct that it would have been Mr. Zwane?
I will take it on your word, sir.
And that this, all of these transactions take place before the 9th of December, 2015. Do you know what happens on the 9th of December, 2015?
No, sir.
There was a significant incident that happened on the 9th of December that Mr. Tlantla Nene, who was then finance minister at the time, gets to be fired. You remember that?
Now that you remind me, sir, yes.
And that Minister Van Rooyen became the finance minister.
Yes, sir.
And that he took with him officials that came from regiments as his advisors, i.e. Mr. Mohammed Bobat. Do you know about that?
I'm aware of that, sir.
So, once the, for how long in your experience do these compliance and certificates get to be issued by DMR in transactions of this nature?
I would be guessing, sir. I honestly don't have an idea.
So in your duration at ESCOM, this was the first and the last instance you had to deal with?
Indeed, sir. In this instance, I was only there for 4 months.
This transaction, who was meant to supply coal to ESCOM under this transaction?
Sir, I would think that the supply agreement was concluded with Tegeta, so Tegeta had the obligation to supply the coal to ESCOM.
So the person who had an obligation to deliver was not ESCOM, but Tegeta.
When you say deliver, sir? Sorry? When you say deliver, you mean?
Coal.
Yes, sir. I mean, the supplier would have to be Tegeta, so they would have to supply us the coal.
Now, why do you guarantee Tegeta, who must perform?
So we did not guarantee Tegeta. We issued a guarantee in favor of Tegeta that ESCOM would have the ability to deliver 1.6 billion rand as envisaged by the board on the day that the suspensive conditions were fulfilled. So we did not guarantee to get.
But who was going to benefit out of that guarantee?
The guarantee would have benefited Tegeta, but the 1.6 billion rand payment would have also benefited Tegeta.
What was supposed to do with the 1.6?
If I recall from the letter that was issued by the DG of DMR, there was some settlement of some liabilities or something or the other that they needed to have done.
See, my summing up of that entire transaction, it was a case of a cash injection to Optimum Coal Mine, with knowing fully that Tegeta was going to own the mine, to ensure that when Tegeta eventually takes over the mine, there was sufficient money for them to run a viable business. Was that your understanding? Was that what you wanted to achieve?
So I think that was what we alluded to in the actual submission to the board itself. I think we did say that it was the 1.6 billion was going to be used by the potential buyer to settle liabilities and ensure that the mine was a going concern, which then satisfied or mitigated the security of supply risk that had emanated as a result of the organization going into business rescue.
And one of the reasons for that is that you didn't want people to lose jobs. That's what is in your submission.
One of the socioeconomic impacts identified was job losses.
Now, when Glencore still wanted to pursue the mine, why was the same considerations not given to them?
So you probably will need to ask Mr. Kopo that question.
Oh. Hello. Yes, I will ask him. But your signature is on the submission. You've associated yourself with the submission.
Yes.
You must answer.
I know that my signature is associated with the submission. But I think at the end of the day, Mr. Coco would be best placed to be able to answer that question. I mean, I rely on my colleagues every day, and their judgments and their abilities. Just like I relied on Ms. Daniels for a number of things as well.
I put it to you, Mr. C, that the reason you can't answer this question is because you were bending backwards and forth, almost breaking your back to accommodate only one company, together. What is your comment on that?
I think that's a rather harsh summary, Advocate. I don't think I was bending over in any way, shape or form. I think I was presented with a transaction that needed to be executed with a mandate from the shareholder. And as a functionary in an organization, we are there to execute on the mandate of the shareholder.
So Tegeta gets to be the beneficiary of the 2.1 billion being squashed. So Tegeta gets a treatment that when you asked why the same treatment could not be extended to Glencore, you can't explain, which of course benefit only Tegeta. Do you see my point?
Sir, with all due respect, I think on the 2.1 billion, on your own version of the reading of the agreement or the letter sent by Mr. Coco, Glencore even conceded that they would settle the agreement via the contractual terms of the agreement that exists between Eskom and itself and Optima. In terms of the explanation on me not being able to explain the same terms and conditions of Glencore, yes, I think it is up to Mr. Coco to explain that, and I rely fully on him in terms of being able to assess that.
Not only did Glencore suffer at the hands of yourself and Mr. Coco, when Exxaro closed the mine that was supporting, is it Arnott?
Yes, sir.
Were they providing coal to Arnott, or which...
They supply to a number, but Arnott is the one. Yes, I remember that.
They closed down. Correct?
That is correct, sir.
People lost jobs there. Correct?
Correct, sir.
This consideration that people should not lose jobs didn't matter to Eskom, it would appear.
No, it did matter, sir. I think the reason for Arnott closing down was not an Eskom decision. The Arnott contract had come to its natural end, as I understand it at the time. And the price at which the contract ended, I think, was 1,132 rand a ton. I think Arnott was requiring 1,400 rand a ton or something like that for it to be renegotiated, and Eskom was not willing to enter into that negotiations, as I understand it. And again, so this was, I think the contract ended on the 31st of March or 31st of December, and I got there, I think, on the 1st of August. So this was, again, relatively new. I mean, it was a new issue when I got there. For me.
Let's go to what has recently been in the media space. It relates to Huarong Energy Africa. Can you explain your involvement in that transaction?
I do recall that the term sheet was provided and the term sheet was signed by myself, But from a perspective of giving you details associated with the transaction, I would be guessing if I could remember all of this, all of the details associated with that.
What was the transaction more or less about? What is it that Eskom wanted to do with this transaction?
I think it was pretty much a funding transaction where we required funding, and I think Horong was willing to provide funding to Eskom.
Why did you sign the timesheet before and during the time when the lawyers were considering the matter and having advised against?
So to be quite honest, I think the term sheet that I signed was supported by the Treasury Department, was supported by internal legal at the time, was supported by the Board Investment and Finance Committee, if I recall. I was not aware of, and I'm actually quite surprised that there was no there were legal concerns associated with the transaction.
No, they were, and I'm going to show it to you. And this you would have known about. You know the lawyers called White and Case?
I do. I do, sir.
Were they not lawyers advising on this transaction?
And they advise on these and other transactions, yes.
Did they not advise against the signing of the term sheet?
That I'm aware of, so remember.
But surely you knew the lawyers were considering this transaction, including the issue of the time sheet.
So as I said, from my recollection, the term sheet was supported by a memorandum that was approved by, well, not approved by, but supported by internal legal at the time, as well as the Treasury function. It had gone to the Board Investment and Finance Committee, and on that basis I executed or signed the term sheet.
Was it not one of the minister's condition that she needed to be properly put at ease about, amongst others, the issue of the timesheet?
So I'm again standing to correction, but I don't recall that we engaged with the minister prior to me signing the term sheet. I think we were relatively comfortable that we had the authority to enter into the transaction. We needed to go to the Board IFC and obtain approval, which we did. And whatever conditions that the IFC had stipulated, my understanding was that it actually found itself or found its way into the term sheet. And that's my recollection of the transaction.
Let me remind you, because your memory seems to be failing you, that this is a memorandum from White and Case. Firstly, that on the 9th of March 2017, they received a draft term sheet that was final and dated 22 February. You wouldn't dispute that?
I have no recollection, but...
And that on the 10th of March, they had an initial meeting with Eskom Treasury to receive background on this particular transaction. You wouldn't dispute that?
Again, if it's in the memo, I would assume it's correct.
When did you sign the timesheet? Which day did you sign the timesheet?
I cannot recall, sir.
The document itself is dated the 14th of March, so it could have been either before or after that. Is that a correct assumption?
I would normally date it the day we sign it, sir.
Yes, you signed it on the 14th of March, 2017. That is the date on the document. And listen to what the lawyers are saying, that on the 12th of March, they provided a written thoughts on the program term sheet, repeating the advice to not sign the term sheet in its current form, and proposing instead at looking at making further inputs, and these included that further detail be provided on the program, that the structure on the diagram and the directors should be reflected. But most importantly, the source of funds. They needed H&E, which is this Huarong Energy Africa. Because they say they noted that HEA was a lender of $1.5 US dollars, and noted that HEA should identify the source of these funds, when and how they would be committed. These are the issues they've raised. But most importantly, on the financial terms, they flagged the financial terms that appeared to be onerous generally, including the following. The term sheet cancellation fee was $3 million US, payable on bad faith cancellation, repudiation, termination of the term sheet by Eskom before the loan framework agreement is signed. That is the first thing they raised around the fees, finances. The signature fee of Alpha, which was a $24 million US fee payable on signature of Alpha, described as a facility fee. But there was no commitment of funds by the company HEA. And this was subject to a due diligence exercise. The due diligence fee was $7.5 million US. They say, despite these, the security of the deposit, which is one of the important things, there was an uncertain amount to be left on the deposit with HEA or a letter of credit guarantee provided. This will be leaving cash with HEA without interest during the loan period that HEA could use freely. Would this kind of a clause in the contract be favorable to Eskom?
Sir, I must honestly say that I am not aware of that legal review that was conducted by White & Case. I don't recall it. I don't recall anyone raising the concerns contained therein prior to me signing the term sheet.
We'll get to that aspect, but what I want to find out and test with you is that if you pen your signature on a contract with this kind of a provision, is that provision beneficial to Eskom or not? Yes or no?
I think, sir, like with all of these specialized transactions, I think we effectively do the best we can. I think, as I said before, it had gone through the due diligences within Eskom, Treasury, as well as legal, and had obtained approval to the extent that ESCOM, IFC, or Investment and Finance Committee had approved it. And if I recall, the term sheet was signed with some sort of proviso that would effectively enable us to negotiate the problematic terms of the term sheet. And that is the purpose of a term sheet in the first place, is that you set the negotiating parameters and you negotiate from there.
But you're not answering my question. As you sit there, are you comfortable? Would you have signed this contract, which you signed, with that provision?
Well, sir, I signed the contract, so I guess it's signed.
Early prepayment. If ESCOM prepays a loan, it has to pay all interest that would have been payable if the loan had not been repaid early. And your lawyers say this is unusual and is effectively, potentially, huge prepayment fee. Nonetheless, you want to sign the contract.
As I said, the due diligence that was conducted, which I did not have sight of. What I take at face value is that it had gone through a process of internal legal, it had gone through a process of treasury, and it had gone through a process of the Investment and Finance Committee. That's what I went on. I have no sight of this document that you're reading from. If you have evidence to suggest that I had this document at my disposal, then we can discuss it. So.
The interest rate, we'll come to the issues that you're raising. The interest rate, this is the lawyers raise a concern, appeared to be 100% of the asset cost or years of the asset life, based on the loans being 5, 10, 15 years. The lawyers are warning that we are not sure what the intention is here. But you went ahead and signed. Now I take that you're not a lawyer. Why would you have signed a legal document when the lawyers are still negotiating and giving feedback to you on the contract?
So as I said, the primary objective of signing a term sheet is to set the parameters for negotiations. So the intention would have been to sign the term sheet, get the legal due diligence done, and negotiate the issues associated with the due diligence that was conducted. That is how I understand a normal process to unfold.
I beg to differ with you, Mr. Singh. This document clearly states that it is binding. The document you sign, the parties agree that this term sheet shall create legally binding obligations on each party and shall be in full force and effect upon its signature. You do read before you sign it, don't you? So how could you have missed this portion?
No, I did not say I missed any portion, sir. I think what I was suggesting was that the terms and conditions of the term sheet would be in effect, but there was still room to negotiate them.
By signing this agreement, do you know that the other party has acted on this agreement, that they've issued a 400 million invoice for ESCOM to pay?
No, I was not aware of that, sir.
Didn't read Friday's Business Day report?
No, sir, I did not.
Because you don't care? Is it because you don't care?
So I find it hard to come to your conclusion that because I do not read the Business Day that I do not care?
I mean, do you normally don't, are you a chartered accountant that doesn't read a business day?
So I think given the experiences that I've had in the last 9 months with the media, I've really not wanted to pay much attention to what was going on in the media.
Okay. Not a single individual gave you a call and said, there is this transaction in the media space, and you are fingered as having authorized this huge transaction?
Sir, I think I was alluded to the fact quite late in the evening by my mother that there was this news report of this 400 million, but other than that, no.
So, at least by then you knew the consequences of you signing an agreement contrary to the advice of the lawyers of the company?
No, I did not, sir. Because as I said, I did not have sight of that document that you're reading from. And if I had sight of the document that you're reading from, I would not sign the agreement. It would have been easier as that.
So you were not aware that your treasury officials were involved in intense, sensitive discussion around this contract?
So if the committee would allow, I would be happy to engage with the company to extract the information like I extracted for all of the other transactions to understand exactly what my role was and what I did and what I did not do. Currently, you're asking me about a transaction that happened almost a year ago. I'm responding to those questions as best I can and from my recollection. As I said to you, this transaction, as I recall it, went to the IFC. It was approved by the IFC. I understand that internal legal recommended it. I understand that Treasury recommended it. That's the basis on which I signed. If there was a due diligence that was done thereafter, I was not aware of the due diligence. But if the committee would require me to give you a full detailed account of that, I'm happy to engage with the company and come back and provide with you, again, just as I've done in these submissions, a submission relating to this transaction.
Okay. There's quite a number of transactions, according to the testimony of Ms. Motepo, that, and I'm going to the relationship between McKinsey and Trillion, that you authorized. Do you remember those transactions?
So there's lots of transactions that are authorized. If you
and let me remind you.
Yes, thanks.
The balance optimization and cash unlocking initiatives, which included the insurance claims management for the Dover Unit 3 recovery project. Does that ring a bell? Do you recall this transaction?
I do recall the transaction, but I don't think we were ever billed for this piece of work that they had conducted.
No, it's not about billing. I'm asking, did you ask them to do the work?
Yes.
The rebuild on Dover Unit 3 recovery project to recover the 600 megawatt capacity loss?
No.
Did you ask them to do any work on the online vending?
As part of the master services agreement, I think they had done some work on the online vending, yes.
The work on the insurance claims management in relation to the Hitachi settlement offer?
As part of the MSA, I think, or the master services agreement, yes, I think they did do some work there.
Optimization of the fibre optimum cable capacity?
Not aware of that, sir.
The overall insurance claims management, you asked them to do that?
Sorry, I couldn't hear you there, sir.
The overall insurance claims management?
No, sir.
The sale of Eskom Finance Company business and mortgage books?
I think as part of the MSA, they did do some work on EFC, on Eskom Finance Company, yes.
The funding model that had to go through the corporate plan of the of Eskom?
They were not directly engaged to do that. That was a subcontractor arrangement between McKinsey and Trillium.
Okay. Was it not your responsibility to prepare the funding model to feed into Eskom's corporate plan?
It was. Well, actually, it's not my responsibility. The corporate plan is the responsibility of the board.
But you're a member of the board,
yes.
So that's your responsibility.
Yes. Though.
And it's finance related, so you must assist the board,
yes,
discharging that responsibility.
Yes.
Why did you not do it? Why did somebody else have to do your job for which you paid?
Well, at the end of the day, sir, in raising in excess of 300 billion, you actually need to be guided and provided with expertise. There was very little to work on from the 2015-2016 corporate plan. The first thing that I did when I got to Eskom was pick up the previous corporate plan to review, and when we reviewed the corporate plan, particularly the funding plan, it was all of 2 pages to borrow 200 billion, right? When I got there on the 1st of August 2015, which meant that a corporate plan had to be developed and submitted by the 28th of February the following year. And given the state of the organization and the number of issues that we needed to deal with and the crisis within which the organization was, and working off a 2-page funding plan previously, it was actually quite difficult. That led us to approach the board for them to provide us assistance via consultants, which was McKinsey at the time, to assist us in developing the corporate plan. There were other issues that needed to be dealt with as part of the corporate plan. There needed to be a coal strategy that was put in place, a maintenance strategy that needed to be put in place. All of these issues were part of the, I think they were part of the equity conditions that had been given to Eskom.
Were these transactions, were there any valid contracts between Eskom and this Trillium?
In terms of the Duva 3 insurance claim work, as I said there, that work was done as part of an investment by Trillium, so there was no billing for that, so there was no contract for that. And it was a relatively short period of work. I think it was maybe a week or two. In terms of the other contracts that you had mentioned, or the other pieces of work that you had mentioned, as I stated, it formed part of the master services agreement with McKinsey. So there was a contract with McKinsey for the delivery of that work. The obligation for a subcontractor to exist was then McKinsey's responsibility.
Let's look at the McKinsey/Regiments relationship. When did, is it correct that Regiments was a supplier development partner of McKinsey in a transaction that involved Eskom?
I'm not too sure, sir. Okay. I would have to guess if I were answering that question.
Okay. Were you aware that regiments, Eric Wood was a director at regiments. You're aware of that?
Yes, sir.
At the time that these transactions that I went through were being performed, they were performed with Mackenzie and regiments. There were staff and officials of regiments. Do you recall that?
I would not be privy to that information, sir.
When Bianca, let's talk about the payment of invoices. The amount of 30 million plus that was paid to Trillion for work done January, February, what was the basis of that?
If I recall correctly, the basis of the payment that was made in April for the 30 million related to the corporate plan work that was done between, I would say, September and the end of the corporate plan, which was the end of February.
Which year?
2016. So it would be work from September 2015 through to the end of February 2016.
Yes, but Trillion was not a registered company at the time, because Eric Wood was still a director at regiments.
Sir, I'm not too familiar with the corporate arrangements between Trillion and regiments. I do know, however, that ESCOM vendor management processes would require that Trillion be registered or as a vendor on the ESCOM database, which I assume would have been done. And that's how the payment would then have been processed in April.
The board chairperson came here and said you lied to the Minister of Public Enterprises in responding to the question from Honorable Mazone. Were you involved in preparing the response for the Minister?
Firstly, sir, I was not engaged by ESCOM on my alleged misrepresentation, as the Chairman alludes to, firstly. Secondly, activity that I performed relating to the relevant parliamentary question that is being referred to was that I was the acting group chief executive at the time, and the submission was prepared by the normal ESCOM processes. It was recommended by Mr. Edwin Mabulani and Ms. Suzanne Daniels, and I then proceeded to sign the submission. If I recall, the responses to the question, I still maintain that we did not mislead in terms of the responses to those questions.
So you accept that you were part and parcel of preparing the responses to the Minister in response to the question?
Yes.
Now, we know that those responses were not accurate.
Sir, my final comment was that, in my view, I think the comments were accurate.
I'm sorry?
I said my final comment of the first initial question that you had posed to me was that, in my view, the answers to those questions were accurate based on the questions that were posed.
The questions, the minister is on record acknowledging the inaccuracies of the response. That's the first thing. The second issue is those responses came from you. Now my question is, did you give the minister the full context of the issues that were raised, or did you prepare draft responses?
I think the process allows for draft responses to be prepared. And the draft responses were prepared. We did not amend the draft responses in any way. The PQ was then signed and submitted in that format, or the parliamentary question was signed and submitted in that format.
Did you give the minister sufficient information other than the draft responses about the entire context?
There was a decision that was made to remove some additional information relating to the Trinilin and McKinsey contract, because the questions were very specific relating to a contract between Eskom and Trinilin. The factual nature of the response was that there was no contract. And as a result of that, there was a question that led from that to say, were there any payments made? And factually, there were no payments made associated with the contract, because there was no contract. The contract existed between McKinsey and Eskom. So that was the responses to the parliamentary questions. The additional information that was provided, given to understand, was the additional information that would then explain the payments that were then made to Trillium.
Well, when the draft questions were prepared, because the answer was not, the questions were not directed at you. They were directed to the minister.
Yes, sir.
With the respect, you're not a member of parliament.
Yes, sir.
So the questions from a member of parliament to another member of parliament, the minister. You prepared draft response. Did you give the minister a briefing memo about the entire transaction, enabling her, having sight of the entire context, to then write a response? Or did you just prepare draft responses?
We drafted draft responses, sir. The additional information was removed.
Why was that information removed? And by whom?
I'm not too sure by whom, sir. I would assume that it was believed that the information did not respond to the questions.
But why was the context not provided to the minister?
In retrospect, maybe we should have provided the information, sir.
Why was it not given to the minister? You are the CFO.
Yes.
For you to make decision on any transaction, when submissions come to you, there's a proper motivation.
I think so. Sorry.
So why would you deprive a decision maker of the same processes that you would demand before making a decision?
I think, sir, in terms of the parliamentary questions, we, in preparing the parliamentary questions and responses to the parliamentary questions, it has been a practice that we wanted to be very specific relating to the questions that were asked and the responses that we were given. And that was a practice that we installed not only at Eskom but even at Transnet.
In the interest of time, I just want us to quickly run through your submission, paragraph by paragraph, not on the entire document. Page 51.
page 51. And that is from paragraph 207. You say there, in October 2015, advice was sought from the ESCOP group compliance regarding the PFMA implications, which is the MSA. You quote the advice you received from ESCOM group's compliance officer on the implications of the MSC. Because you say feedback received from group compliance was as follows. Go to page 52 and you quote verbatim. You say there is no basis within the significance and materiality framework to make an application to the Minister of Public Enterprises, regardless of the value, namely under the PFMA, DPE approval is not required, and likewise, nor are we required to inform our minister of the transaction. But I want to put it to you that you have conveniently and deliberately omitted the first part of the paragraph of the document. And I'm going to give it to you, and can you please read that portion that you omitted? With your permission, Chair, can we just give the witness this email? There's an email in front of you, sir. Where does that email come from?
The first portion is from Dale Seacott to Mr. Lahey and Ms. The email is from Mr. Dale Seacott to Mr. Lahey and Ms. Mokatle, and CC to Mr. Govinda and Mr. Neo Tsalanku.
Can you read for the record what the first portion of that email says?
Notwithstanding past guidance regarding cost containment restrictions and the need for an exemption from the Minister of Finance, there is no basis within the significance and materiality framework to make an application to the Minister of Public Enterprise regardless of the value. That is, under the PFMA, DP approval is not required, and likewise, nor are we required to inform our Minister of the transaction unless the information provided is pertinent and related to the exemption requested. Dale.
Now my question to you is, why did you decide in your submission, can you switch off the mic,
sir,
to omit this portion that says notwithstanding past guidance regarding cost containment restrictions and the need for an exemption from the Minister of Finance? Why did you omit that in your response?
To be quite honest, there was no reason. There was no particular reason. Because it doesn't add to the requirement for us to inform the minister based on the significance and materiality framework. Sorry.
Did you attach in your submission that email?
No, sir, it's not.
But that provision says says there's a need for you to get an exemption from the Minister of Finance.
It says, notwithstanding past guidance regarding cost containment restrictions and the need for an exemption from the Minister of Finance, there is no basis.
No. And the need for an exemption from the Minister of Finance. Now, you have omitted that in the response. And you quote that advice as the reason why you did not obtain exemption from the Minister of Finance. Now, my question is, why, firstly, did you omit that portion in your response? Secondly, why did you not attach that email? Because clearly you had the email.
Firstly, sir, the email that you refer to formed part of the negotiation process.
No, Mr. Singh, please. Can you just please tell us the simple reason why you did not attach that email in your submission? Secondly, you did not quote it in its entirety. Why?
Well, I'm trying to explain that, sir. Firstly, the submission that you have before you, as I explained originally when I started with my presentation, this was a process I inherited. So some of the stuff that's in this document was not my first-hand knowledge of what had happened. It was put together to provide the committee with an understanding of the entire process. This email, for example, a case in point, it's the first time I see this email. In terms of the reason for the first sentence being omitted, I can't tell you that because this is the first time I see the email. In terms of us requiring an exemption from the Minister of Finance, again, it's the first time I hear of that.
Mr. Singh, sir, how could you quote from that email without having seen it?
So as I said, the document has been prepared by me to provide the committee with an understanding of the transaction and some of these some of the information, particularly as it relates to the negotiation part of the MSA itself, was not privy to me.
Can you stop the mic, Mr.
Sorry.
For you to have quoted the man, what you've quoted in your submission, you must have had that email in front of you. Is that not so? Or did you miraculously know about the contents of an email that you've never seen before?
No, sir. The submission was prepared by myself as well as other people. So this portion of the presentation was prepared by one of my colleagues, Mr. Prish Govender, and I would assume that that was at his disposal. There are a number of files that contain a number of these documents, so I'm assuming that this email is contained in one of those files.
I put it to you, Mr. Singh, that that conduct was a deliberate ploy on your part, one, to distort the advice that you'd received, and secondly, to mislead the committee. What is your comment on that?
I deny that categorically, sir. This is the first time I see this email.
This document in front of us, the committee, are you beginning to disown certain portions of this response?
No, sir, I did not disown portions of it. In my introduction, I did say which portions of the transaction I was involved in and which portions of transactions I was not involved in. I said to you originally that I inherited this contract. The negotiations had begun way before I got there. I inherited the contract. I managed it and terminated it. This had formed part and parcel of the negotiation of the contract.
Can Can we step off this point, go to on page 52, point 211. There's a reference that has been made. You say that the final internal audit review report was completed on 12 December 2015. There's annexure AS 20. And the conclusion of the report, and you go into details. And this was an internal audit review opinion on the master service agreement, which states that National Treasury guidelines were followed. That is what you say. And that National Treasury cost containment instruction was not applicable. That is what you say. And the opinion you say is dated 12 December. In your submission you say it is dated 2015. Can you see that? Page 52, I mean paragraph 211. Get there. Are you there? Sorry, are you there? Now, you say that opinion was dated 2015. Can you see that?
I do see that, sir.
And before the proceedings here, you took us through where you made certain adjustments.
Yes, sir.
This opinion, I put it to you, was obtained in 12 December 2016,
you
not
correct.
2015.
You are correct, sir.
And why did you state it as 2015?
I think it was an error, sir, which we had not picked up.
You see, I put it to you that this is another attempt to mislead the committee. And why I say so? You had to put December 2015 there, because what the significance of the year would mean that you received the opinion before you signed the contract, as opposed to after you signed the contract. What is your comment on that?
Sir, I disagree with your comment. The intention with respect to obtaining the internal audit opinion was not to have the internal audit opinion prior to signing of the contract. The intention of the internal audit review was to ensure, as I said in my opening statement, when we're doing the settlement process, I requested three things to be done: an internal audit review, a legal review, and a verification on the fees payable, which was the Oliver Wyman report. That three things were requested in and around, I would assume, sometime in October, November 2016. So this is clearly, in my view, this is clearly a error that we did not pick up. But it was never the intention for us to have an internal audit report in 2015. It just didn't exist.
Were there two conflicting internal audit reports? Was there an audit report on the 6th of November 2015? Are you aware of that internal audit report?
No, sir.
Remind you what that report said of the 6th of November 2015. Which is not contained in your submission. And under the, this is what the report says under the table dealing with the risks under paragraph C, dealing with the cost containment instruction.
internal audit stated that the deviation approval is required from National Treasury. Do you remember that?
Sir, I don't recall that, but I understand that it was a matter of contention.
And again, this critical document is missing from your submission.
Sir, I would hazard to suggest that there can't be two final internal audit reports on the same matter. The one that we have included in our documentation is the final signed internal audit report that I would assume, if there was a concern that was raised associated with the with any compliance matter, the evidence associated with that was provided to internal audit to their satisfaction. And hence they then issued the report on the 12th of December 2016. Not 2015 as we have recorded it.
I have in my possession a memo report on McKinsey and Company's top engineering program from the Assurance and Forensic. I'm going to ask the chair permission to give over the document to you so that I'm not unfair on you. Can you see the document? It is dated at the end of the document. Can you see the date there? This is from Molefi Nkabu,
yes.
Senior General Manager, Assurance and Forensic. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Is the date there?
Yes, sir.
The date?
6th of November
2015. Can you repeat?
6th of November 2015.
Can you go under the table dealing with risk under paragraph C?
Yes, sir.
What is the heading there?
National Treasury Cost Containment Instruction on Cost Containment Measures Dealing with the Engagement of Consultants.
What does that document say about the deviation? Under consulting fees, the second last paragraph in that block.
Consulting fee expenses and performance incentives to McKinsey and Company will be paid out on realized savings to a maximum of 12% per project. These could lead to a deviation to the National Treasury Cost Saving Instruction. A request for a possible deviation from the instruction must be made to National Treasury as per Section 79 of the PFMA.
Okay. So you didn't know about this?
Sir, no, I don't recall this.
Okay, let's move on.
But again, I think just in terms of the date of this document, sir, if you look at it, it's addressed to the chairman of the McKinsey Master Services Steering Committee. Now, that steering committee, as I understand it, was only established in February 2016. So the date of 6th of November 2015, I think, would be inaccurate in this document itself, because that steering committee did not exist in 2015.
Okay. You didn't prepare the document. You didn't know of its existence. Is that your testimony?
Sorry?
You don't know, as you sit there, of the existence of that document. And that is the reason why you would not include it in your submission.
I agree, yes.
Let's move on. Page 10.
Chair. Page 10. And paragraph 19.17, where you deal with the fixed price contracts that include Medupi. You see that?
Yes, sir.
You're referring to a fruitless and wasteful expenditure, then, correct?
Correct, sir.
If you believed, as you believe now, that it was a fruitless and wasteful expenditure, did you disclose that in the financial house of Eskom?
Sir, this is my view at this stage. When I was requested to prepare the for the committee in terms of governance at Eskom and particularly contract management, these amounts that are quoted here date back about 3 or 4 years. The information was audited by the Eskom auditors at the time. I don't believe that they had viewed it as fruitless and wasteful expenditure, but in my view, I would think it would be fruitless and wasteful expenditure, hence I raised it for the benefit of the committee.
Irrespective of when it happened, but you had an obligation of reporting and disclosing that, correct?
Correct, sir.
Failure, you're aware that failure to disclose fruitless and wasteful expenditure is a criminal offense.
I was not aware of that, sir. But I would take it on your word.
On page 15, paragraph 37. Paragraph 37. There's 310 million which employees were disciplined. That is what you're saying. The Back to Basic program referred to above was reported as irregular expenditure in 2015 amounting to 310 million. Which employees were disciplined for this?
Sir, I'm not too sure if I know that when I got there, I inquired about a disciplinary process relating to this 310 million. A document was prepared, but I don't think anyone was disciplined associated with this 310 million. And the reason why I know about this is because it was one of the outstanding matters from the 2015 audit that needed to be resolved when I got there. And there was, I think, if I recall correctly, a condemnation of sorts that was being prepared and to regularize this matter.
So no one was disciplined for 310 million?
Not that I recall, sir.
I put it to you that no one was disciplined as a matter of fact, and you can't dispute it because you can't recall.
Sir, this, as I said to you, emanated in the 2014-15 year. I was not there in 2014 or 15.
you were not there, but you picked it up. Correct? What did you do after picking it up?
I requested a memorandum to be drawn up in terms of what was the circumstances that gave rise to this, and why was it why did it emanate, and who was disciplined. And from the memorandum that was prepared, if I recall, pretty much the memorandum had indicated that most of the individuals had left ESCOM, if I recall the memorandum correctly.
I dispute that these officials would have left, because Mr. Koko himself is still at ESCOM today. And this issue related to his division.
If you say so, sir.
Question to you is, if you went to the board for condonation and writing off of this expenditure, did you do that?
I think there was a condonation request that was prepared, but I don't think it actually served at the board, because in my view at the time, the amount was not condonable because it was just irregular. And I said to the guys that if it is irregular, you can't go and ask the board to condone something that you know is irregular just for the sake of fixing it. So I think that was my take on it at the time. And I think due to the, I'm standing to correction, but I think this would have been one of the amounts that would need to have gone to the minister for her condonation as well, because I think the project was part of a bigger project. So it would have had to go there. And I said to them, guys, if we're going to do this thing, we're going to have to inform the shareholder as well.
On page 15, paragraph 40, you say that the spend without contracts that was in place was 6 billion rands. This would clearly be irregular expenditure, correct?
I would assume so, sir.
Did you deal with this in terms of the PFMA?
So if you look at page 17, the bullet point that starts since April 2016, that's all the activities that we undertook to address these concerns that we had identified in paragraph 40. The diagnostic that we had undertaken was not conclusive. We had actually issued this to the organization for them to address these issues, and it was under the auspices of the CPO at the time, who needed to deal with these issues. And also, I think the external auditors didn't flag these contracts at year end as part of the audit process.
Did you disclose these in the PFMA reports? Did you?
So again, as I said, the diagnostic was not conclusive. It needed to be investigated by the contract managers themselves, and the CPO would have made a call as to whether they were irregular or not, or the line users would have made a call as to whether they were irregular or not, which would have led to them following the PFMA process in terms of being reported and so on. So if these were genuine, I would say, contracts that were not in place, it would have followed a PFMA disclosure process.
I thought we'd agreed that these, in your view, were irregular expenses.
On the face of the report that was presented, they would have been irregular expenditures. But you could not take it on the face of the report as it being conclusively irregular expenditure. There needed to be further analysis and investigation conducted relating to the 6 billion worth of transactions.
Page 16, point 41. You're referring to examples of poor contract management that potentially could lead to contraventions of the PFMA. This just coal, when was it cancelled?
I think that was during the period, should have been April or May 2017, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was May 2017.
And was this disclosed in your financials?
No, it was after the 31 March, so we would not disclose it. But I think it was raised by the internal auditors, external auditors, in their audit report to the audit committee.
And would that be the same with the deemed energy supply, the energy payments?
Deemed energy payments, no. This is, again, in my view, this was frivolous and wasteful expenditure, but I'm not too sure if the auditors actually picked this up as part of their review. And again, I think the PFMA process would have had an explanation as to why these are not frivolous and wasteful expenditure.
This chief procurement officer you recruited from MTN.
Yes, sir.
The specialist in large scale procurement.
We did go through a recruitment agency, and there was a short list of candidates that was provided to us. I think we shortlisted in four candidates. I prepared a set of questions that was then provided to the board tender committee, and they interviewed the three shortlisted candidates and recommended the individual for appointment.
Reading your page 19 under paragraph 46, do I understand you correctly that you say these transactions, the prepayment was taken by BOD, that is the Board of Directors, and that the 600 million was authorized by BTC, the McKinsey company and its subsidiary Trillion was approved by BTC, optimum coal penalty, those issues, you had nothing to do. Do you understand it correctly?
Correctly, except for obviously the 1.6 billion, I was part of the board that approved it.
The 1.6 billion?
Yes.
So, do I understand you correctly to be saying the decision makers must take accountability for those transactions?
Indeed, and also to demonstrate that, in my view, I did not have the ability to influence the outcome of these decisions because it was a collective decision, particularly on the prepayment of 600 million. I was not even part of the BTC. I was required to do three things. On the McKinsey and Trillion transaction, as I said to you, I was not there at the inception of the transaction. I inherited it, managed it for the time that it was there, and ultimately recommended its cancellation. On the optimum penalty, settlement. As I said to you, my involvement was via a request from Ms. Daniels to sign the ultimate agreement because of the fact that she thought that she needed to have segregation of duties.
So the earlier on you saw the invoices that I showed you, that clearly at the face of those invoices shows that your trip, at least the December 2015 trip, would have been paid by Sahara, a company associated with the Gupta family. And Trillion itself associated with them through Salimisa and Eric Wood, because they paid that, those invoices paint a picture that you stay at Oberoi in Dubai was paid by them on the face of those documents.
So my version was that they were not paid by the Gupta family, and that is my version.
Yes, I accept your version, but I'm asking you on my version,
on your
as
version?
Evidence on the face of the invoice that I showed you.
On the purported invoice, yes, sir.
Yes. And on the strength of that, if indeed, because there's two versions, there's your version, there's the other version. I'm saying on the other version, if it is true between these two versions, there could have been a potential conflict of interest in you having to deal with a prepayment of which Tegeta was to be a beneficiary.
I would assume so, sir.
What we know now is that you did not recuse yourself. Correct?
Correct.
We'll get back to the details of some of your failings in that regard, what I view as failings in that regard. You indicated that you and Mr. Koko co-authored the submission on the 1.6 billion rands and persuaded the board of directors to approve the prepayment to Tegeta.
That's correct. Our signatures are on the document.
And later, after the board has approved what you had persuaded it to approve, you come back and you say, sorry, there's a financial risk here. Why was that financial risk not observed when you prepared the submission?
As I originally stated when you posed the question earlier, the risk was actually a legal risk that was identified through the contracting process. We responded with a financial risk mitigation measure to ensure that the transaction was still executed. So it was not a financial risk that we identified. It was actually a legal risk that emanated from us actually paying 1.6 billion rand up front without having the ability to have an effective contract in place.
Chair, can I just get a 10-minute adjournment? There's just one or two issues that I'm trying to locate, and I'm not in a position to locate them. Thanks.
Thank you, Advocate Barnara. It 10 minutes looks to be very short. I was going to give you a 30 minutes break because it has been a long day, and then you come. Yeah, I've got many reasons for doing that. Then when you come back, you wrap up, and then the members will continue after you. Can I do that? Can I take the 30 minutes?
Yeah.
No, ufuni break. We'll take a 30-minute break, member. Advocate Vanna.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Singh, thanks for your patience. You'd recall before the break that we had a discussion around this Wang transaction and the timesheet. You recall that?
I do, sir.
I conceded to the fact that you did not have certain documentation before. And I'm sorry for that. Apparently we are experiencing some challenges with printing documents. But I've since had the documents printed. You indicated that you signed the timesheet on the approval of the IFC and the advice from legal and the legal compliance. Is that correct?
I would, if my recollection is correct, I would say so, yes.
I have in my possession the minutes of the IFC, and I am going to ask a copy thereof that it be handed over to you. There were two copies. I don't know how these documents disappear. Any documents? Copy. Yeah. Okay, can you give it to Mr. Singh? It is not the minutes, it is the action list of what has to be done subsequent to that meeting. I would like to take you through to some of the discussions around this issue at the meeting. You remember that I was reading from the lawyers that Treasury had engaged with on the issue and the concerns that they had raised. One of the issues that Dr. Naidu seems to have pointed out was the issue around the guarantee. This is what he had to say. He pointed out that the guarantees offered by Treasury incurred no costs to ESCOM, whereas private funding would incur costs. he inquired whether the relevant financial evaluations had been done in this regard. Mr. Pillay stated that analysis of the delta had been done and comparison of all funding elements and cost elements had been done. Funding from Huarang was found to be positive to Eskom. The worst case scenario would have been negotiated on what Dr. Naidu says. However, even this worst case scenario stood up to scrutiny. During the number of years of construction of the asset, Eskom would pay nothing. Payments and interest would only be effective once Eskom has taken delivery of the assets. So it would appear that one member is making an argument for the transaction. But what I want to get to is the resolution that is recorded. It was resolved, that is on under paragraph 7.31 of the document. The Investment and Finance Committee, under resolution, approved, this is the approval, 7.31, that Eskom Treasury be mandated, to negotiate, comma, and in bold, but not to conclude a financing agreement with Huarang amounting to between this, with a full disclosure of names and shareholders and the value / percentage of each shareholding being presented to the committee as part of the feedback report. Now the 7.32, as the CFO, was authorized to give it to 7.31. Now, clearly there is no approval for you to sign the timesheet. So where did you get it from that the IFC had approved the transaction?
I think as I indicated originally, this transaction was conducted almost a year ago. My responses to you was on the basis of what I recalled. An important document that is not part of the documents that you provided to me, sir, is the document relating to the memo that would have accompanied this document that I would then used to have signed. And in the absence of that document, it would be amiss of me to actually say that any further information relating to this. I would be happy to, as I said before, provide the committee with all the necessary documentation relating to this as and when I get the access to that information from the company. But for me to respond on this basis, I think it would be counterproductive.
Chair, on a point of order.
Okay.
It's now about 4 to 5 hours that we've heard this refrain. That was 9 months ago, that was a year ago, etc. But the whole purpose of giving Mr. Singh notice that the key issues that pertain to Eskom are XYZ, you've had time to prepare. Each of us is going to tell you, Mr. Singh, you are lying, you are evasive, you are less than helpful, and there are worse conclusions we're going to come to, Chairperson, if you continue in this way. We all have other things to do here. You think we're little children that each time we ask you a question, you say, I don't remember. It's somebody else who did it. I'm not responsible. The document was prepared by somebody else. So, Chair, could you direct Mr. Singh? If he doesn't want to cooperate, he must tell us, and we as a committee must decide what we're going to do. But we can't sit through this farce, because that's what it is at the moment.
Thank you, Honorable Gordon. I do remember that last year we said to him we have given him 6 months in from June to December last year. We thought when we took the when we went on recess,
he will recollect all the information that is supposed to be in your disposal, Mr. Singh. I think the members are not getting satisfactory questions, I mean answers, and in your in the submission there are things that you have not responded to that are in your submission. There are things that are not in your submission that you were supposed to put in your submission. And remember, you are speaking under oath. Therefore, satisfactory questions are expected from you. You can't always say, I don't know, I don't remember, because what you are asked of, it was your daily job that you were doing in ESCOM. I think, Honorable, you, Advocate Vanar, continue. But Mr. Singh, we are expecting satisfactory answers as per the oath that you have signed.
MJ, can I respond?
I don't think you have to respond. What you should do the correct thing. That's the only thing that I'm asking from you.
I have been doing the correct thing in my view, Madam Chair. This transaction that we are talking about here was not one of the four transactions that I was requested to prepare on. And yes, the committee has given me adequate amount of time to prepare for the transactions that I was requested to cover. And I have done that in the submissions that have been provided. In the submissions that have been provided, I did not respond by saying, I do not know, I cannot remember. The only transaction which that relates to is the one that has been presented by Advocate Varana that was in the newspaper last week. So that's the only comment I would like to make.
So you don't know, you only read it in the newspapers. You read about your job in the newspapers.
No, ma'am, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that the subject matter of the advocate's questioning relates to a transaction that was raised in the media last week.
All the more reason to be prepared, Chairperson. All the more reason to be prepared. We can't specify every transaction. All the substantial transactions that have come to our notice, it is fair, Chair, that a CFO who is well paid and supposed to be well qualified, we'll talk about his integrity a little later, must have answers for us. Otherwise, this is gross disrespect for Parliament, let alone misleading us. And that's criminal.
Thank you, Honorable Gordon. Advocate Vanara, can you continue, please?
Thanks, Chair. And you see, Mr. Singh, I would not have pursued these answers had you not, I mean, these questions had you not provided the answers that you did. Because the reality of the situation is that I'm asking you about the answers that you provided. And now, all I'm asking is that here is the documentation. And the documentation disproves your responses. What are you saying to that?
Sir, based on the information that you've provided, I do agree that based on this, it says that the ESCOM Treasury has the mandate to negotiate but not conclude. But again, I would refer you back to my original response to say that based on the information that I was given at the time, this document was concluded. This term sheet was concluded. So I would like to have an opportunity to look at the document that was provided at me at the time. But as far as I knew at the time, the IOC had approved us to sign the term sheet. Sorry.
And that you were ably supported by your compliance and legal team. That was your response. Is that correct?
And Treasury.
And Treasury. You're adding Treasury. We'll deal with the Treasury later. But I've given you a memorandum from ESCOM. And that memorandum is from the corporate specialist of legal and compliance. It's dated the 22nd of August 2017. It's addressed to Suzanne Daniels, who's GE Legal and Compliance. You've got the document in front of you, sir. Now, I just want to go to the discussion in the document, which is on page 2 of the 7-page document, under the heading, the binding term sheet. Can you, for the record, read what is written there from 9.1? Yes.
A binding term sheet was signed by ESCOM in regard to the EFTA and other related issues. I was not part of the team advising on the binding term sheet and was only given a copy of the signed term sheet on 14 August 2017.
That proceeds until 9.4.
The binding term sheet was signed by Anuraj Singh on 14 March 2017 in his capacity as Chief Financial Officer. Such is attached as Annex C. In this document, as this document binds ESCOM contractually and financially, such should have had at least the support and or approval of the group executive, ESCOM legal and compliance. I have not seen any document in this regard. I have reviewed the various submissions to the board tender committee and IFC in this regard. And
sorry, Mr. Lee, can you speak a bit louder? I'm sorry for interrupting you.
I have reviewed the various submissions to the board tender committee and IFC in this regard, and none give a mandate to ESCOM Treasury or the Chief Financial Officer to enter into a binding term sheet. At a high level, this is a potential breach of the PFMA as it would be committing ESCOM to a non-value add and unauthorized expenditure. WNC were on brief through ESCOM Treasury on this term sheet. They were brought in 9 March to review the draft term sheet. WNC had advised ESCOM against signing the term sheet because of its binding nature and the severity of the binding conditions to the detriment of ESCOM. Their advice is recorded in the memorandum attached herein.
Now again, legal, this is the interaction between legal and the compliance division. Is it correct that they do not seem to know that they would have advised you to sign on the timesheet?
Correct.
So, and there's no record of any advice that says you are to sign. What the only record that is there is the advice obtained from WNC that the timesheet should not be signed.
As I previously stated, sir, I said a document such as a term sheet will be accompanied by a memo. The memo will be signed by various people. On my recollection, I said, in the absence of that memo, I would assume that group compliance and legal had sight of it and would have been supported by Treasury. And my recollection at the time was that the IFC had approved it. That memo would have given me the comfort to be able to sign this term sheet. This memo is not here. So on my recollection of what has been said, that's my response.
If you then had this memo that would have mysteriously, I say mysteriously, because we now sit with the resolution of the IFC that clearly says something contrary to what would have been in this submission you received. We're sitting with legal as well as the compliance unit that also say actually there was a legal opinion from an external lawyer that had advised against the transaction.
I originally said to that response as well, I was not aware of the fact that that legal opinion existed when I signed on recollection of the events.
You see, the resolution says, and I accept that Case would have communicated with Treasury, because clearly from the resolution, it is not you who are actually working on the contract negotiations. It was Treasury was mandated.
yours was to supervise that particular work in your capacity as the CFO. But let us just imagine that indeed, as you want us to believe, that Treasury supported you. In view of the opinion that Treasury obtained before you signed on the contract, on the 9th, that is what the document says, they had obtained already a legal opinion from WNC. 9.4 of the document says, WNC were on brief through ESCOM's Treasury for the term sheet. They were brought in on 9 March to review the draft term sheet. They advised ESCOM against signing the term sheet because of the nature and the severity of the binding conditions. Now, I put it to you, Mr. Singh, there is no way that a Treasury official would, in his or her right senses, when knowing that the lawyers are busy looking at the matter and they are advising against signing off the term sheet, that they would have written to you and said, Mr. C, the CFO, please go ahead and sign the term sheet.
Firstly, Advocate, I think the date on which the memo that was submitted to Treasury was, I think they were engaged on the 12th, you quite correctly, but based on your statement that you made earlier on, I think the document that was eventually given to Treasury relating to the risks was given to them on the 12th, based on your comments, if my notes are correct. And we signed on the 14th. Okay. Equally, Advocate, I would suggest that if a Treasury official was not going to prepare the memo relating to the signature of the document, it would be highly irregular for me to consider signing the document in the absence thereof. And I would have not signed the document in the absence thereof.
I agree that to the extent that had there been no ulterior motives, a CFO would ordinarily not sign a document of this nature without having had contributions from Treasury, as was the case here, as well as legal. That I agree. But would you equally concede that a CFO in your position who had no interests of ESCOM, who wanted to benefit an external service provider for whatever reason, would have signed the term sheet contrary to the advices?
Advocate, there's a file before you of 400 pages odd, which have been presented to you in December. We got thrown out of Parliament for submitting it late. And these 400 pages demonstrate the diligence with which we had gone through to try and approve these transactions, as we, albeit that they are questionable now. It would be very remiss of me to go ahead, for whatever reason, and sign a document like that with no documentation. It just does not make sense to me, in terms of the conclusion that you've just put to me.
Let us move, because you, I guess, suggest that we have exhausted the issues on the 400 document. We haven't, and we're going to deal with those. And one such is the prepayment of the 11th of April, 2016, where you were asked to give the BTC assurances and also the commercial viability of the transaction. Remember that? And you are on record saying that you were happy with the time that you had been given, and that you are happy with the work that you were asked to have done and given a report back to BTC. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, this transaction was, Eskom was going to buy coal from Teget. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Tegeta did not own a mine at that stage.
I would assume so.
I take it that you're assuming, you are not disputing the fact that Tegeta was not the owners of
yes.
the mine.
Yes.
And that this coal was sitting with Optimum Coal Mine.
Agreed.
So there was a middleman introduced in this transaction, which is Tegeta.
Correct.
And you managed to negotiate with Tegeta a 3.5 discount.
Yes.
Now, this is now again common sense. I'm not a CFO. If Tegeta was to go purchase coal from Optimum Coalman and then sell it to someone else, they would want to make a profit out of that transaction. Isn't that so?
Correct.
Instance, if they bought the coal from Optimum Coal Mine, say for 16 rands per ton, they would top up to make up for their own gain. Is that not so?
There would be a margin that they would add, yes.
And that is, I assume, the margin that they would have given you a 3.5% discount.
Highly possible.
Why were you comfortable with that kind of a transaction as the CFO? Why did you not advise the BTC that it will be cheaper and in the benefit, the best interest of Eskom, to get coal directly from Optimum Coal Mine?
I think the operations guys are probably better suited to answer that question. But if I recall, the reason for that was that the business risk group practitioners at the time had concluded an agreement with Tegeta for all of the coal supply from Optimum, or the excess coal supply from Optimum. So from that perspective, the coal that was available from Optimum was available through Tegeta and not directly from Optimum, if I understand that transaction correctly.
I've been requested by one of the honorable members. They're just asking for you to repeat your answer.
The response to the question was that the operations people are probably better suited to answer that question. But I think the reason for that particular circumstance was that the business rescue practitioners had entered into an agreement with Tegeta for the excess coal that they had at the time to be sold to Tegeta. And therefore, when we went out on a request for coal, the suppliers that we had approached, basically Tegeta and I think one other supplier was identified to supply the coal. Else else Optimum themselves would have responded to the query, I would assume.
This coal, is it correct that it was to be supplied to an power station?
I would think so, yes.
And that at the time, Tegeta was already supplying coal to ANOT in a separate contractual arrangement?
I'm not aware of that. I'm not sure.
But is this not the due diligence that you were meant to do?
Sir, the due diligence, that, as I understood it, was to understand whether there was a commercial rationale for us to enter this transaction, which, the way I understood, I executed, fed back to the BTC, that BTC accepted my assessment, and we concluded the transaction. If there was a need for me to do additional work, I would assume that the BTC that approved the very same transaction that you are referring to would have requested me to do that. My understanding of what I needed to do at the time was to basically do the commercial analysis that I did, relating, or the financial evaluation that I did at the time, where we compared the cost of coal versus the cost of diesel. And that was acceptable to the BTC at the time.
In my reading of the resolution, it was not specific. It said you needed to look at the commercial viability of the transaction. You were not limited to anything. You chose to limit your scope to that.
Again, I would respond by saying that the BTC that effectively gave me delegation or request of that information to be conducted, I fed back to the very same BTC. If they had a different expectation of what I had presented, they would have requested it.
I fail to appreciate your response, Mr. Singh. The BTC has reservations about a transaction. They have been brought, this has been brought to their attention at short notice, and they're looking for assurances from their chief financial officer. And they're asking the chief financial officer to do a lot of things which involve due diligence. It's not limited. If you limit it, you limit it yourself. There is no restriction there. And you limit it, and you're not telling them that there are other issues that you have not considered. Did you tell them that you only looked at the areas that you say now you looked at?
So firstly, as I considered, I was not aware of the other supply into ANOT from Tegeta. So I couldn't inform them of something I didn't know. Secondly, I would still stand by my response by saying that if the BTC was uncomfortable, they should have not approved the transaction in its meeting of the 11th of April. Secondly, in its meeting of the 13th of April, if there were still further concerns that they had, they should have directed those to me and I would have addressed them, or not, or raised the concern and said, listen, these are the concerns we have.
My question is a very narrow question. You've now articulated that these were the issues that you looked at. So my question is, did you play open cards? Did you take the BTC around the issues that you looked at? Yes or no? And if so, what were
the issues that were at my disposal and knowledge at the time? I did take the BTC around, yes, I did.
Am I correct that there was an RFQ, RFP, request for proposal, that was requested, that was issued, inviting service providers for a new contract because Exxaro's contract was coming to an end, 31 December 2015. As CFO, you would have known about that process.
I must say, as CFO, I would have, I don't recall it. And I wouldn't, at that stage, procurement was, procurement did not report to me. I would not have been aware of an RFP. that was issued to the market. No.
You've forced me to make this conclusion of you. And you'll recall that I've asked you, don't force me to make adverse inferences from your testimony. You remember that earlier on, I asked you not to do that.
So I can only respond to the best of my knowledge, and I'm responding to the best of my knowledge. If I didn't know that there was an RFP, I didn't know that there was an RFP.
My question is very simple. Do you recall earlier on when we started, I asked you not to force me. I'm not even speaking for the committee because already you hear comments coming from members. Not to view you differently than I viewed you when you came in this afternoon. You remember that? Please place it on record.
Yes, I do.
I'm getting a distinct impression from you, sir, that you are very evasive on issues that you had a direct responsibility on and where things didn't go right, and that you are quick to point to others where you think the blame lied. Is that a fair observation?
I don't think that's a fair observation, sir. If I did something wrong and I missed something, I would be the first to put up my hand and say, listen, I missed something. And I didn't do it. And I didn't do it correctly. As you questioned me before, and I said, in hindsight, maybe we should have done it differently. And I conceded to that. So to say that I point elsewhere and don't take accountability for my own actions, I think to the extent where pointing somewhere else does give a reflection of where the accountability lies, then yes, I will do that. But if the accountability lies with me, then I will do that. As I said, in terms of this term sheet, I agreed. I signed the term sheet. I didn't deny that I signed the term sheet, even before you presented the term sheet to me. All I said was I don't have the necessary documents for me to recall and understand the circumstances under which the term sheet was signed.
So, whilst working on this transaction, your testimony is that you did not know there was an RFP issued to replace Exxaro's supply of coal to Arnold. You don't know that?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Is it correct that if you had asked, in your mind then, who was supplying? Or let me rather put it this way. Were you aware that on 31 December 2015, Exxaro's contract was coming to an end?
That I was aware of, sir. That I was aware of.
Now, as CFO, how were you going to get a replacement of Exxaro?
Sir, as CFO, I would not... That would not be in my area of responsibility. At the time, that was in the area of the group executive generation and primary energy.
And when faced with this situation, knowing who had the relevant information, assuming that you didn't know, would it not have been diligent of you to go and find out about the replacement of Exxaro?
Sir, with all due respect again, I think the submission that was made to the board tender committee relating to the transaction in April was made by, I think, the chief procurement officer at the time, supported by Mr. Koko, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And I would assume that all of the operational issues relating to anode supply would have been discussed at that meeting. I was not part of that meeting.
So assumption is based on the important information that would have been collected to get to the decision. Is that correct?
I would have assumed that whatever was required for the BTC to get to the conclusion where they approved the transaction on the 11th of April, barring the three things that they had requested me to do, was provided satisfactorily to them. Subsequent to that, on the 13th of April, when I presented my analysis to them, I equally assumed that whatever information they required was provided to them.
This RFP, because you say you don't know, you must accept what I'm saying, that there was in September of 2015, and after you joined in August. Maybe you were too busy or you were still learning the ropes and you missed that piece of action. There was a September 2015 RFP issued to replace Exxaro's contract, which was coming to an end. And that process, because the submission points to that, this is what I don't understand. The submission that went to BTC spoke about that. Did you read that submission to inform you the context of implementing what you've been instructed to do in view of the fact that you were not at the meeting?
Firstly, if advocate you assert that an RFP was issued in September, then I take it on face value that an RFP was issued. Equally, it is unfair to assume that the CFO would know about every single RFP that is issued by an organization as big as ESCOM. Thirdly, yes, I did read the submission, but as again I said, I assume that all of the operational issues that pertained to the 11 April approval by the BTC was addressed by the BTC to its satisfaction, given the resolution that was taken.
Would it not have been, I accept that you see you had one service provider to negotiate, and that service provider gave you a 3.5 discount. And the contract was extended, because that was more of a contract extension as well, the contract extension, is that correct, until September for the supply of coal.
My understanding was that it was not a contract extension. It was a new contract, hence we concluded a new supply agreement with them, if I recall correctly. But I might be mistaken, as I was not at the meeting.
There was a short, I must concede to what you're saying, that was a short-term supply of coal, which would have been for 5 months until no later than 30 September 2016. You recall that?
Agree.
When that contract came to an end, or towards the end of that contract, ESCOM went to National Treasury seeking a deviation for the extension of this contract. Do you know about that?
I seem to recall it, but the details of which I'm not clear of.
Treasury responded by saying they were not going to give you or give permission for deviation. Was that communicated to you in one way or the other?
I don't recall it.
But you see, this is what people at Treasury do. National Treasury, that is. Who do due diligence? They refused the deviation and said ESCOM must go obtain at least 3 or 4 RFQs. I see you nodding. Does that mean that you are aware of this?
I've nodded because I would agree that that would be an appropriate way to deal with it.
And you know the outcome of that process was that the coal that you negotiated, a 3.5% discount, where there was 3 or 4 service providers, what was the negotiated price that you got? Was it 19 rands?
I don't recall, sir. But if you say so, said that.
That the service provider that was eventually allowed to continue the work was quoted ESCOM at 14 rands. Can you see the difference?
I see the difference, sir, but I would also ask if it was the same quality in terms of CV.
You know, the company, before Exaro's contract expired, was there anything about the quality of the coal of Exaro? Forget about the other issues surrounding Exaro, but the quality of the coal, was there any issue raised?
I'm not too sure. That was just when I got there, sir. So I wouldn't know that.
I'll tell you that there was nothing wrong with the quality of the coal that Exaro was furnishing in the mine. And you know why I'm asking that question. It is Exaro who quoted the 14 rand price.
I'm not saying that there was a quality issue with Exaro's coal that was supplied to ESCOM. All I'm saying is when we compare 14 rands to 19 rands, I'm saying we should compare it with an equivalent CV. So if 19 rand was 23 CV coal, is 14 rand 23 CV coal? That's all I'm saying by making that comment.
The point that I am making by this long-windedness is that ESCOM had to pay 19 rands for a coal that could, as it proved later, that could have been obtained for 14 rands. Now, I find it, because of that, I find it a bit difficult to be faced with a CFO that says, I did a due diligence test, I negotiated for 19 rands, and yet, 5 months down the line, the price that ESCOM gets coal for is less than what you negotiated.
Sir, with all due respect, the BTC did not ask me to conduct an entire due diligence of the transaction.
Not the entire.
They asked me to do a commercial rationale for the transaction, which I did, which was compared to the cost of diesel versus the cost of coal. It was acceptable to them. They had, as I said, I read the minutes of that meeting, they had requested assurances from the team that had presented from the upside associated with the cost of coal. And they were assured at that point in time that the cost of coal that they received under this transaction was competitive. They went out with a request. They, I think, got, I think it was 8 suppliers, if I'm not mistaken, and they ended up with 2, which was Tegeta, and I think it was BT or one of the suppliers. So I'm assuming that the BTC was comfortable with the pricing associated with the transaction. And they did not ask me to conduct a due diligence relating to the pricing of the transaction.
I'd like us to go to the prepayment, the 1.6 billion. The submission that you and Mr. Koko co-authored, let me just get to that submission. The submission is dated the 8th of December 2015. It refers to verification by an independent party. And that is referred to as Regiment Capital. Remember that. As I indicated, didn't you see any potential conflict of interest that Regiment Capital would do this verification?
How so, sir?
The beneficiary of this transaction was Tegeta. Was there no shareholding of some of the shareholders of Tegeta in regiments?
Not that I'm aware, sir.
So that matter, I'm sure one of the members would pursue with you. I want us to go back to the page 20 and point 54, which also deals with this prepayment or this 1.6 billion. You speak of a draft contract that Ms. Daniels presented to you and Mr. Koko on 10 December, correct?
That's correct, sir.
And this is a contract that the board approved on 9 December that you must give effect to, correct?
The contract was not presented to the board, sir. Only the submission was presented to the board.
Why was the contract not presented to the board?
It was not prepared at the time, sir. The contract was only prepared subsequent to the board approving the transaction. If the contract was part of the submission to the board, it would have been appended as an annexure.
So there was no, the submission spoke of a pre-purchase, not a guarantee, correct?
That is correct.
So when Mr. Zetembe Khoza, your former acting chair and subsequent chair, when asked about this guarantee and when he said he didn't know about it, he was telling the truth?
Correct, sir.
This guarantee, was it a performance guarantee or what that you prepared?
It was a form of a performance guarantee that Eskom had the ability to perform, meaning that we had the ability to pay 1.6 billion rand on the fulfillment of the suspensive conditions.
But is it not true that in pre-payments or pre-purchases, that it is the company that must deliver coal that must give guarantee?
I think in this case, sir, the difference was that the Eskom had to perform by prepaying 1.6 billion in cash. That is what the PTC approved. I mean, the board approved. In return for that, Tegeta would supply coal for a year, or whatever the terms of the contract was. But because the board approved a payment of 1.6 billion for the payment of coal, or for the purchase of coal from Tegeta, when the draft contract was prepared, the draft contract had suspensive conditions like Competition Commission, DMR approval, and so on and so forth. That would have meant that I would have had to pay 1.6 billion today, and the contract would only become effective when those conditions would have been fulfilled, which obviously is a length of time. In terms of the contract, we gave them until the 31st of March for those conditions to be fulfilled. Okay. Now, in order to give effect to or comfort to Tegeta that we had the ability, when those suspensive conditions were fulfilled, to perform and pay 1.6 billion, instead of paying 1.6 billion and being at risk for the fulfillment of the suspensive conditions, the guarantee was issued in place. So we didn't have to pay 1.6 billion and not have an effective contract.
That is what you define as this legal risk that has been correctly identified by the lawyer. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that comes after the meeting of the board. Correct?
That is correct.
So the intention between yourself and Mr. Koko when you approached the board was to get a 1.6 billion in cash. Is that correct?
That was the intention behind the submission.
On the basis that it is a pre-payment arrangement, correct?
That is correct.
In a pre-payment arrangement, shouldn't there be security furnished by the recipient of the prepayment?
That is correct. In the draft contract, or actually the contract that was then signed, I think the security that was provided at the time was inventory. No, it was not. The shareholding was in the 16th of March transaction. In the December transaction, I think it was inventory that was provided as security. Sorry.
When you, Mr. Anuj Singh and Mr. Gogo, went to persuade the board to advance a 1.6 billion in cash to Tegeta, knowing that there has to be security for that, what was the security you had in mind? And why was it not in the submission to the board?
I think the submission does make reference to security being obtained via inventory. If I recall, I think it's AS3, page 107, paragraph 2.2.3. It says counterparty risk will be mitigated by a cession of
the
call risk.
Can you give me the reference?
It's annexure AS3, page 107.
And what is the document?
It's a submission to the board.
Oh, okay. Where in the submission to the board?
It's paragraph 2.2.3. It says counterparty risk.
Sorry, can I just first get there?
Sure.
2.2.3. You can read.
2.3, the solution relates to the pre-purchase of coal to the value of 1.68 billion, which mitigates supply risk. Counterparty risk is mitigated by a cession of the coal to ESCOM.
When, at the time that you were preparing this memo, had this session been done, or was the session done already, or was it still to be done?
No, this session was, as I said, I think the approach that would have been taken in all cases would have been for us to negotiate, get the approval of the board, and then negotiate for the contract to be put in place, as well as the session to be put in place.
In your submission, Tegeta had to use money for specific reasons. Is that not so?
Which submission, sir?
Sorry?
Which submission? Which transaction?
The 1.6 billion. The motivation was that the company is under business rescue, that they're buying. They needed to invest to do some cash injection,
yes,
to enable it to bring the company into operations. How did you ensure that the money went to what your motivation said?
I think firstly, sir, the transaction was never consummated, so the money never actually left ESCOM. So the 1.6 billion never went from ESCOM. So the reason for that was the suspense of conditions was not fulfilled by the 31st of March, and the transaction expired and the guarantee expired. So there was no money that actually went to get it. under this transaction.
This is one of the reasons. It's written here in the submission. Go to 3.6.2.
Yes, sir.
It says the proceeds of the 1.68 billion prepayment of coal are to be used by OCM to extinguish existing liabilities to ensure that the business continues as a going concern. Correct?
Correct.
Whilst I take that, that was the intention when you wanted to prepay. That guarantee you gave, because you didn't give them cash for the reasons you advanced.
Yes.
Do you know what Tegeta, what it enabled Tegeta to do?
No, sir, I'm not aware.
If Tegeta had gone to raise money to purchase Optimum, in other words, they go to any bank and say, we've got a 1.68 billion, borrow us money, for whatever reason, was that within your control?
That was certainly not within my control, sir. But I would hazard to say that the guarantee that was issued on the basis that it contained the same terms and conditions, and it contained the same suspensive conditions as the contract, and also was not transferable and not negotiable. So any financial institution that would look at that guarantee, in my view, would understand that that guarantee is suspensive, pending the fulfillment of that suspensive conditions. If they had to advance 1.6 billion against that guarantee, they would be taking significant risk, because as you would know, that the transaction actually was not consummated. So if they did advance 1.6 billion against that guarantee, there was no way they could perfect that security.
But a possibility exists, as you say, even if there's a stupid bank and they do advance, cash on the basis of that, they will decide whether to take the risk or not. You would not...
That's their risk to take.
So the point that I'm making, there was a possibility that the guarantee you used could be used for acquiring loan for whatever reasons.
A very remote possibility, yes.
Sure, that was the last point for me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Advocate Vanara. Honorable members.